Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Full Scale Outdoors Podcast. I am Dale Luganbill. Thank you for joining me, tuning in. On today's podcast, we're going on a little trip. Here we are in the midst of winter, the icy cold grips in the upper Midwest of Minnesota. It is quite cold, actually, which is great because we're making ice. People are jonesing to get up on Mille Lacs, and a couple of resorts are, well, kind of sort of letting wheelhouses and trucks out. I'm not going to get into that in this one. But yeah, so people are really wanting to get out. Anyways, instead of talking about more cold stuff and wintertime action, I'm going to take you to where it's the summertime, the Southern Hemisphere. We are going to travel to South Africa. As I was at the St. Paul Sportsman's Show, and I have to be honest, I was relatively unimpressed by the show overall. I don't know, maybe I'm just not in the mindset for summertime stuff yet, but there's a lot of trucks and boats and RVs and Canadian resorts and stuff like that, and there was a fair amount of people, but it wasn't busy by any stretch of the imagination. And I walked around, had my podcasting equipment with me, looking for stuff that, you know, kind of jumped out at me that I thought would interest me, would interest you. And honestly, just didn't really find much, except for this booth. As I am a sucker for African safaris, and I just love all the wildlife over there and the different kinds of game animals. And I do enjoy the greater conversation about trophy hunting and what trophy hunting is, what it means for conservation. And we get into that. So I stopped in to the Hannes, I'm going to screw this name up, Swanepoel Safaris booth at the show. And, you know, I got to talking to him, you know, introduced myself and if he was interested in the podcast. And he said he'd be down. And there were kind of, you know, there was people about talking to him. So I didn't want to, you know, I wanted him to push his stuff. So I said, well, I'm going to check back later and it gets a little slower. And then, so I did. And then we did it. We sat down. We had a fantastic conversation. It was exactly what I was hoping to have. There's some really good insights in here from somebody in the industry, somebody boots on the ground in South Africa. And we get to some real truths about African wildlife and trophy hunting and what all that means. And he corrected me on a couple things, so that's great. I mean, that's, we need to, you know, we're fighting an uphill battle when it comes to misinformation in the social media world, you know, about the endangered species and hunting is under fire and danger of all sorts of stuff. So this is a great episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it because I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed talking to Hans. This is amazing. So I'm not going to ramble on too much more outside of to remind everybody, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe to the Full Scale Outdoors podcast. Like, rate, and review where possible, and share it with anybody you think that might be interested. I greatly appreciate it. It really, really does help spread the word and gets us traction. As the more traction we have, the more and great guests that we can get on, such as today's episode. So here we go. Let's do it. This is the Full Scale Outdoors Podcast with Hans Swanepoel.
Oh, here we go, boys.
Go. I love that sound. This is a good one.
Well, welcome to the Full Scale Outdoors podcast. I appreciate you taking some time here at the St. Paul Sportsman Show and sitting down with us. Like I said, I will have you introduce yourself. Let everybody tell everybody who you are.
Yeah, I'm Hannes Swanepoel. I own the safari company, Hannes Swanepoel Safaris. And we run out of Mishlashla Game Lodge, quite an unpronounceable name, but it's in the...
That is a mouthful.
In the Lowveld area of South Africa, near to the Kruger National Park.
That's, all right, so that's a good talking point, the Kruger. I think a lot of people are familiar with that. That got a lot of press a few years ago with, was it a National Geographic documentary, I think, down there, like the Lions of Kruger.
Yeah, there have been a lot of documentaries on it. It's one of the oldest national parks in the world, established in the early 1890s. It's a huge area, really well known worldwide.
Yeah. It's escaping me now, but there was a video that people caught. I think it was of, was it a lion and...
The lion that caught the buffalo and the crocodile grabbed onto
that.
And that was tug of war. And then the other buffaloes came and saved the buffalo.
Yes, that's exactly the one I was thinking of. Yeah. That kind of put, at least for me, it put Kruger on the map.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people too. So that gives them a good point of reference for that. So you're booking hunting trips here. You do trophy hunting in Africa, and which I want to talk about. But also you do like ecotourism too.
Yeah, we do photographic safaris, we do hunting safaris, as well as fishing safaris throughout Southern Africa.
Yeah, I was looking at through your book there. I get lost in that book. We've already talked about half my subject matter, but we'll get into it. How is the industry right now?
The industry is pretty good. Tourism in South Africa is one of our biggest industries. It's a really important industry in terms of conservation. And providing funding for a lot of our wildlife areas, both through photographic as well as consumptive utilization tourism like hunting. It's really important to a lot of our conservation areas.
Do you find, and then we're going to kind of get into this subject, but this might be a good segue. Do you find with your customers that come down and do the more ecotourism, the photographic, they ask you a lot about the hunting side of it?
Not so much, but we try to include it in everything we talk about, because conservation and utilization is very much holistic. You need to include all of it. You can't just do photographic and you can't just do hunting. It needs to be included, because certain areas and certain uses are more specific. So if you can combine the two and cover a bigger spectrum and generate income in different times of the year, it just works better in general.
And if you have to control a population of any sort, cameras don't do that.
No, unfortunately they don't. But you do need that on one side, but the management of the species and habitat is important. And although trophy hunting doesn't really reduce populations much, it does take out some of the older animals. And it also provides the bulk of the funding for the conservation of all the other areas.
I think that that's a good point that I think misses a lot of people, that the trophy hunting doesn't really help call numbers. You know, nobody's looking for a call animal if they're spending that kind of money to go over there. Is there management practices over there? Like some people, like the, you know, you can't bring the meat back to the United States. But we talked earlier that there are some local hunters. Do they do more of the management hunts?
Your local hunting industry is massive. It's more than twice the size of our trophy hunting industry financially. And that is mostly by local South African hunters hunting primarily for meat. And it generally taking out your masses of animals, your female animals, the ones you need to reduce in your population to keep population population growth under control. So that's where that sector of it comes into play, is not only your local hunting market, but also your local meat harvesting market for both local use and export use. A lot of our game meat gets culled on a large scale and exported to Europe. as well as utilized locally.
Really? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that either. So there are other places in the world that you can bring the meat home back to? Is this
The big problem is the import into the USA. A lot of our European hunters will sometimes take some of the meat back to Europe. It's got to go through a control system.
Okay.
But the USA doesn't allow any, and neither does Australia and New Zealand and that kind of stuff allow any of African meats back into their country.
And is that just under the umbrella of health?
Disease control.
Disease control, okay.
We've got a lot of endemic diseases in Africa, such as foot and mouth and a few others. And it's just safer not to let anything, put a total ban on it, than let anything have an opportunity to slip in.
I guess that makes sense.
Yeah,
it would just be, I always imagined growing up when, you know, watching the shows and the magazines and dreaming of hunting these exotic animals. But because I just love to eat wild game, I always dreamt of, like, going into my freezer, looking at all the packaged meat and be like, do I want an impala steak tonight? Do I want a kudu? Maybe an eland? What am I feeling like today? And I just think that would be, like, super cool. But I can't do it unless I move to Africa.
And that's one of the good things about coming over and doing a hunt in Africa is that you'll get to taste a lot of what you hunt. We'll prepare something of everything you hunt, put a kudu tenderloin on the grill at night, or do a chicken fried steak out of an impala backstrap. Or
I have no idea what that tastes like, but it just sounds so good. You said kudu tenderloin, my mouth starts watering. I have no idea what that would taste like. What is there a pretty wide range of, like, flavor profiles for the game?
Not really. Most of our antelope species taste quite similar. There's some of them that have a unique flavor, like springbuck is a really dark meat. And because it eats a lot of little forbs and herbs and things, it has quite a rich flavor to it, really good. But most of our grazers and that kind of stuff have a very similar taste. Something like zebra is exceptionally good, very tender, very flavorful. Hippo is outstanding. So a lot of the creatures that a lot of people might think would not be great are actually surprisingly good.
Well, two things. One, horse used to be pretty commonly consumed, even in this country, at the turn of the century.
Yeah.
It wasn't until they started becoming pets where people had a problem with it. And now it's like, if you tell somebody to eat a horse, they're going to lose their mind. But second, you said zebra.
Well, I'm in America. You got to speak American.
No, I don't want you to speak American. I want you to speak zebra. That's how when I watch the shows, they say zebra.
Yep.
And I want to say zebra because I think it's
just
cooler.
As good.
We went through some of the names that, like, Americans just pronounce it differently. Yep. So, like, zebra is one. What was the other one? Not a gemsbok.
We call it a gemsbok.
A gemsbok, and that's the Dutch influence, right?
Yeah, that's the Dutch pronunciation of the G. Yep.
Gemsbok. I'm going to start saying that. I'm going to be that guy. I'm going to be that guy in America that corrects everybody with the correct way to say it.
Yeah.
No, I like that, though. Zebras just sounds way cooler. Mm-hmm. Anyways, gemsbok. What was the other one that we talked about?
Wildebeest or
Wildebeest. Yeah. That's the one that started it, because I was like, ooh, the V with the W, that's got to be Dutch. Yeah, so Wildebeest.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are cool, too. There's just so many different kinds of game out there. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
In Southern Africa alone, we have over 52 huntable species of large mammal. I mean, that's astounding. When you come into our areas that we traverse in and that kind of stuff, on every average day, you could see a few hundred animals of 10-plus different species just driving around. Herds of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 impala, herds of 30, 40 wildebeest. Some of the areas all get herds of buffalo of over 300, 400.
Oh, my gosh.
That's just phenomenal to see that amount of animals out and about.
That's just a massive, like, just the biomass of that. That's a lot of, buffaloes are just huge. So. To see all those in one spot. I mean, they got to leave a good trail.
It leaves a good trail. You can see the dust trail long before you even see the herd.
You don't need a professional hunter to track that herd down. You probably, anybody could probably find those, I suppose. Mm-hmm. What's the most popular?
Most popular, especially for first-timers, are general plans game package, something like kudu. Kudu is always number one on most guys'
list. They're my favorite. They're great.
And then your common things like impala, warthog, blue wildebeest, zebra. Those kind of things are all very popular. And then most guys coming to Africa will come back again. It is that special.
I bet.
And then generally on the second time round, they'll come do some of your more exotic things like Nyala, Sable, Waterbuck, and maybe Cape Buffalo and something like that. But it's probably one of the most addictive things you could ever do.
Like, it's just so exotic. I gotta just assume. I mean, just going to Africa would be an experience that I would love to do someday for sure. And a haunt would be awesome as well.
Yeah.
But I think just even going there would be just to see it.
Yeah.
And is this a preserve, I assume? Do you operate under a preserve?
All of these areas are on private land.
Okay.
So it's private land. All of them have got fences around. Most of them are massive big areas. Now, the main reason for the fences around is to basically contain the wildlife and also to keep livestock and people out. So it's a combination of the two. It's not a system where we got little preserves where you got 20 animals in and they put in there to be hunted and that kind of stuff. These are complete wild, sustaining, self-sustained populations of animals.
Yeah, there's a wide range. When you say high fence, like some people get kind of triggered here in the States with high fence because they think it's not sporting, that the animals can't get away, you know. But it, you know, do you have 20 acres fenced in, or do you have 20,000
acres? We got 20,000 acres fenced in.
Yeah, exactly.
With elephants and buffaloes and lions. I mean, those animals get eaten by lions and elephants every lions and leopards every day. So it's completely wild. Those animals do not hang around. The hunting is tough. It's on foot. It's tracking, stalking. It's exciting. You can be following an impala one day, and a lion could be following the same impala.
That would be trippy.
That kind of thing. It's something like you do not experience anywhere else.
There's always probably the you start becoming the hunted at some point in time.
It has happened, yeah. I've been with a guy from Ohio, and we're sneaking up on some impala and some really thick brush, and suddenly the impala started snorting and looking to the side of us, and I wasn't sure what was going on. I looked over, and he has two big male lions probably 50 feet from us.
Oh, my
God. Stalking those same impalas. We made a quick retreat out of there.
Yeah, so. Go ahead. Play through, sir. Yeah, wow. That would be intense. I can only imagine. You have to have seen some crazy things go down over the years.
You do. And it's all about, and that's what's nice about the hunting side of things, as compared to the photographic. Photographic, you spend a lot of time on vehicles, seeing, looking at the things from the outside. Whereas when you're hunting, you're actually interacting. So you're there on foot. You're interacting with the wildlife. You're getting in their personal space. It's a whole different experience. And because you're moving unobserved and undetected, you get to experience things where the animals are behaving completely naturally without knowing you're there. So you do see some really, really cool and interesting stuff.
God, I can only imagine. What's the bird life down there?
Phenomenal. Southern Africa, our area around us, has got over 900 species of birds. I'm an avid bird watcher as well. I take trips and tours for bird watching tours in our summer months. Just phenomenal. And what's nice, it's just everywhere. You can do it anywhere and everywhere. So.
And we get lost in the weeds when we talk to, like, the trophy hunting. This would be a good way to get into that. Like, that term in today's day and age can carry a negative connotation with some people.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people that hunt have a pretty good understanding of what it means and the conservation that comes side of it. And on the anti-hunters, you're never going to win them over. Mm-hmm. But the people in the middle that are they're not hunters, but yet they're not, you know,
One of the big misconceptions about trophy hunting is that people think it's just pure out of enjoyment and they just take what they want and leave the rest. Out of all the forms of hunting, trophy hunting is the one that utilizes the most of every animal. The hides, the horns, the bones, the meat, everything gets utilized off of them. Whereas a lot of your general meat hunters are taking the meat and not utilizing the rest. So it is the one form of hunting that firstly utilizes more than any animal. It generates two to three times the amount of income than any other form of hunting. And it's not all about chasing the biggest animal out there. Trophy hunting nowadays has become a lot more about removing old animals, providing the younger animals an opportunity to breed and take over the herds. So it's become a lot more of a conservation tool in terms of conserving not only your species, but your genetics within the species.
Sure. And so, like, what's the...
outside of the fences of the preserve, how is African wildlife?
There's still a lot of wildlife throughout South Africa and especially more so your other Southern African countries. We've got a lot of commercial agriculture in South Africa, so because of that, we need to fence off a lot more areas just to keep the wildlife out of your commercial agriculture areas. Lions and cattle don't do well. Elephants and a corn crop doesn't do well. So we need to separate in terms of that. And that's what a lot of people don't realize is having the vast numbers of elephants and large herbivores that we have, trying to do subsistence farming where one elephant herd can wipe out your entire year's crop in one night. And to be able to live in those conditions and have to deal with that and then have the pressure put on us that we shouldn't utilize them because it's a world heritage and all the rest of it. But the rest of the world is not contributing towards the damage caused by these animals. So it's a whole different perception.
I got, what kind of fencing do you got to put up to stop an elephant?
It's got to have electrics in it. Man. Nothing else keeps them back. So you got to scare them with the electrics. But, and even then, if he wants to go through, nothing's going to stop
him.
He's
getting through. Yeah,
so you got to create an environment that he doesn't feel he needs to go there.
And crops like are one thing. Like corn is one thing. Yeah, I mean, like they would decimate a corn. But, yeah. I mean, they can take down trees.
Fruit trees.
So if you have an orchard, they're going to push a thing right over.
Yeah, yeah. And elephants love citrus. So there's nothing better for an elephant than an orange. Now, you can imagine him in a citrus orchard. It will be amazing.
Just drop a couple elephants in Florida and see how well your orchard does.
Yeah. See what the people say about it then.
Yeah, but the elephant is a good subject matter because they're on the endangered species list
No,
as
they're
a
not.
Whole.
That's a big misperception. People think elephants are on the endangered species. They are not. Southern Africa has a major problem with elephants at the moment. There are 2 to 3 times the amount of elephants that we should ecologically be carrying. We cannot get rid of enough elephants. We cannot cull enough elephants, even if we had the infrastructure in that to do it. And because they are such a destructive creature, they are threatening many other species through total habitat destruction.
Well, and it's kind of a double-edged sword, too, because you have the agriculture. If that's, any part of the world that has, modern agriculture, you're deforesting large tracts of land, converting it into fields where you can plow it up and plant corn and plant these monocrops, and nothing else lives on that land that plant in which you're planting. I mean, you kill every other plant, you kill every bug.
Every rodent, every bird.
I was kind of building up when I asked you about the birds earlier inside the preserve. I imagine once you get to these big farms, you're not going to see a lot of those birds.
Well, that's the thing about these hunting areas. It's not just about conserving the animals. It's about conserving the habitat. You're creating habitat, prime habitat for all your other species. Your ecological balance is so much better in these areas. So it's providing the more of a holistic approach to conservation with a spin-off and being paid for by a single sector of that population.
Right, and that's kind of what I try to get across. Like, I feel like that's the angle. It just seems easy when people are arguing about it and they're trying to be, pro-hunting or pro-trophy hunting. They use a lot of the same arguments, and they just... They go through one ear and out the other. They don't have enough depth behind it as far, to carry the weight, to really reach people that might not have an understanding of it.
Yeah.
You know, when you say, this is a wildlife management area here in the States, and that, it's so we can hunt ducks or deer or whatever it is, I think the important thing to get across is that, yes, it's set aside for people to go in there and kill animals, but what's happening with that large tract of land that can't be developed, that can't be farmed, it's just going back to nature. So
creating
all the
perfect habitat for everything else.
Animals are benefiting, down to the bugs, down to the worms in the soil, to the fungus, to the everything. Yeah. You've got how it was before man got there and started toying with it, really. Mm-hmm. And so, and like I said, it's being paid for instead of taxpayer money or something else, a government-funded entity, like a park, our national park system here, which is great. I love the park system. Is awesome, but that is funded through public dollars, not voluntary, paid for when people
And that's exactly it. And with the pressure on us to, well, pressure from the world to stop things like trophy hunting and that. If you, just in South Africa, if you had to stop trophy hunting and trophy exports to countries like the USA, like the UK, like Europe, we would probably lose 2/3 of our conservation land in South Africa. That would go back to commercial agriculture, absolutely, commercial livestock farming, which means you're losing the whole ecosystem and all the other species dependent on it, going back to a monoculture system. And so that's why it's important for us to be able to export trophies, to be able to bring foreigners in to provide that vital funding and protection for these big conservation areas.
Yeah, I get how it's confusing for a lot of people, and they have a hard time connecting the dots of, by killing an animal, you're helping the species as a whole, but then even the bigger picture, like I said, not even just that species, but every other species that's going to benefit off of living in that protected land that's not being plowed under, or it's not just being developed into a factory, you know, that's going to create even more pollution. I mean, what kind of pollution are you creating out there but elephant farts? I mean,
nothing. It is probably one of your most sustainable, eco-friendly activities there can be.
Yeah, and the elephants, I know, are just I actually thought as a whole they were endangered. Now, that's great that you corrected me on that. But I know, like, there's certain parts of Africa.
There are certain areas where they are more threatened. Towards Central Africa, Kenya, that kind of thing, where elephant populations are under threat through illegal use. But in most areas where there's commercial hunting of those species, the populations have actually absolutely thrived because money is going back into the protection, into anti-poaching, into providing water, into providing prime habitat for these species. And wherever you do that and wherever you create value to wildlife, they absolutely flourish. Hmm. To the point where in South Africa, we now, 50, 60 years ago, had about 500,000 head of wild animals, antelope and large mammals. We now have nearly 20 million head of those same species.
That's great.
Over a 50, 60-year period, and it's all through creating value, putting value on these animals, putting value on wildlife areas, to provide habitat for these animals.
Yeah, you don't get that. And I don't want to take anything away from, like, the, you know, the photo safaris, but there's just not as many people doing the photography thing, and the price tag isn't as high.
And that's exactly it. There are a lot of people doing the photo safaris, but your percentage of income or percentage of expenditure from your photo safaris compared to your hunting safaris that actually goes to conservation work is a tiny fraction.
Yeah.
Where a huge, probably 10 times more of the money generated from hunters actually goes into conservation as compared to photographic safaris.
Well, and the other thing they like to do is demonize, you know, the rich American hunter, you know, that comes over and he spends just for his ego, you know, that they like to just demonize him. But really, thank God that we have rich
and
wealthy
the thing
people
is
out there willing to spend.
Those are the people that realize that the future of conservation depends on what they spend. So it's not about going over there and paying a bunch of money to kill an animal. It's about paying money for the privilege of hunting and paying for the conservation of their zoos.
Absolutely.
And that's the whole mindset shift we've had over the last 20, 30 years, is people realizing that by them coming over there and harvesting animals and paying for the privilege of that experience, they are paying for the future of conservation and the future of the conservation areas.
There was an American hunter a few years back. That was quite a while now. Corey Knowlton, and he bid on a, I think it was a rhino hunt.
Black rhino hunt. Yeah.
And he got it. Do you remember what the price tag was?
$350,000.
And I heard an interview with him, and when they asked him how much it was, he said not enough.
Yeah.
He's like, where are the rich? Where are the Hollywood elites?
Yeah.
Why aren't they outbidding me by the millions?
Exactly. This guy's put money into conservation. Rhino are probably one of our most threatened species in Southern Africa at the moment because of the high-scale poaching taking place. Because we are not allowed to trade in rhino horn, because we are restricted on our hunting of rhinos, we don't have a lot of funding coming into conservation. The amount of money being spent nowadays in Southern Africa on anti-poaching work, trying to fight these these war gangs going after our rhino is astronomical. And if it wasn't for guys like Corey providing that amount of money, now you convert that back into African currencies, that's a huge amount of money.
Right.
And all of that money is going straight back into conservation for the harvesting of one old post-reproductive male rhino.
Are there any breeding, is there any captive breeding, within parks of, hunting preserves doing that?
Not within your government parks, but on private land. There's large-scale breeding, especially with things like rhino, because you can't look after rhino in 100,000 acres. But if you put rhino into 500 or 1,000 acres, you can provide the protection they need around that area. So unfortunately, because of the massive threat on rhinos, a lot of our rhinos have been removed out of large areas, not all of them, a lot of them, and put on private land where they get the super protection. These guys have got armed guards with them 24/7.
Do you get a lot of poachers trying to get into your preserves?
Not really our preserves, but we spend a lot of money on anti-poaching. We've got armed guards 24/7, electrified fences. We've got people out surveying the area all the time. And you need to. But at the end of the day, that's an expensive part of a conservation.
Absolutely.
And somebody needs to pay for it. The government's not paying for it.
No.
All these animal rights organizations, although they're collecting money for it, are not paying for it. That money doesn't get to the ground where it's meant to be getting.
Listen, it goes into their pockets. I don't know about, all over, if the World Wildlife Federation, I haven't looked deep into them, but here we have the HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States, and they're one of the worst. The amount of money they bring in, and you look at the pie chart, and because they're a nonprofit organization, their records are public. You can go on Google, you can look at this, and you can see where their money is spent. Mm-hmm. And the millions and millions and millions of money that you are donating, thinking you're helping an animal somewhere, is not going to help these animals.
It's not getting onto the ground where we are.
It's going to create more advertising to get more of your dollars, and it's going into these people's pockets. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. I mean, I find that much more offensive than killing an animal.
Exactly.
One animal.
Exactly.
For $350,000. Mm-hmm. It's
become a major threat to conservation in Africa. Is the Western theory of preservation and
isn't that the irony? Isn't that the irony of it, that an animal rights act, a group, is a threat to African wildlife? Yeah. I mean, I think that really is the message that. That's and the kind of new message I think we want to portray.
And it's not only your African wildlife. It's your African people living with the wildlife.
Oh, I can only imagine.
That their right to utilization and right to conserve their wildlife has been taken away by a group of people that have no vested interest in the conservation, in the utilization of these species.
Well, the Cecil the Lion thing was a huge setback.
That is a huge thing. And that's where the media comes into it. The media blew up something, created a whole bunch of false media, load of organizations made billions out of it, and it was a completely legal hunt. It was an old lion that should have been killed long ago. $50,000 going straight back into conservation. Unfortunately, somebody had named him, and it just blew up. That whole thing has caused more damage to lion conservation throughout Africa than any other single event.
That's just terrible. I mean, there's a lot of misinformation, unfortunately, out there. So I guess we can use this opportunity to kind of clarify, what were the ramifications of that? They did shut down due to public outcry. They shut down the lion hunting in Zimbabwe.
No, they didn't shut down the lion hunting. Certain countries shut down importing of trophies from that country.
Okay. Which stopped people from going there.
Shut down a lot of it. They put thousands and thousands of families out of work. Which was their sole income. A lot of your rural families and communities rely on your hunting conservation to pay for their schools, pay for their clinics, pay for their living expenses. And that was suddenly taken away. Their right to utilize that and to live off of it was taken away by a group of people who have no real vested interest in the conservation of these animals.
And there's a different, even the term poaching, mm-hmm. there's different kinds of poaching, right?
Yeah.
You've got
yeah.
the very poor family mm-hmm. that's living there that's trying to feed
Your basic subsistence poaching, which, although not legal, is understandable. I mean, everybody needs to live. Everybody needs a bit of food.
And then
you get the commercial poaching, and that's one of our biggest threats.
Right.
And that's where we're spending a lot of money, is fighting that commercial poaching. Unfortunately, there's so many people at high levels involved in a lot of it. So it's a really tough one to fight, because you're fighting the guy on the ground, but you're not fighting the guy paying for it all.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. But then to go to, like, when you said you put those people out of jobs that were working to protect lions, really, because it was a livelihood for them.
Exactly.
Now they probably have to go and poach because they just lost their job. Now they got to poach animals just to eat. Now you're back into the subsistence poaching.
And where the lion used to be a commodity to them, an asset, they could afford to lose some of their livestock every year to lion because it wasn't a problem. They'd regenerate that from hunting. Now the lion is a total threat to them. It's got no value. It's killing their livestock, which is now their only source of income.
Or their family.
So a wildlife asset has now become a threat to them. So it has no value. It has no right to existence in amongst them, their families, and their livestock.
Yeah, that's just, how do we go about, like, what's the best way, do you think, like, how do we turn the tide, or how do we reach more people with this kind of a message?
We need to get out and do what we do now and spread the right message. We need, as hunters, as conservationists, need to get out and reach as many people as we can, to the point where we can tell our governments, listen here, you have no right to stop imports of trophies from those countries. You have no right. That is paying for their conservation. We agree with those people. We need to stand up and support your hunting organizations, your conservation, true conservation organizations, the guys providing the funding and the protection for these areas. And the more people we can reach through talks like this and discussions like this, the better for us. There's lots of people out there that are fed so much misinformation, and the more right, true information we can get out there, that's the only way we're going to win this battle, is by educating and informing people.
And that's why I like how you have the setup here. You have the hunting side of your business, and then you also have the ecotourism, the photography side of it. And I like the fact that you bring it up and you talk to the people that are just taking pictures, and you know, it's not you're not convincing them, like, you should also hunt. Like, it's not for everybody. I'm not going to tell somebody who has no interest in hunting, like, yes, you should hunt. Yeah. I just want them as an ally.
Yeah.
I just want them to realize.
That's always one of my biggest discussion points in these talks that I have, is everybody's entitled to their opinion, what they like and don't like. I don't mind if half the people out there don't like hunting. That is fine. Every one of us are a little different. What you need to do is understand that it has a role to play in conservation. And don't stop it from taking place. You don't need to like hunting. I don't mind it. Each of us are different. That's entirely your right. But don't turn that into a system of stopping an important conservation tool.
Yeah, fighting that like the court of public opinion, if you will, like we touched on, you got the Lion King effect going on right now. You said that, like, warthog hunts are down.
Yes. Yeah. Because
nobody
can't kill Pumbaa.
Nobody wants to kill Pumbaa. You can go, the hyenas are fair game because they're the bad guys. Yeah. But isn't that weird how we like that?
It is weird. And it's amazing how that is used to generate income for your aunties and that kind of stuff. Is the disneyfication and glorification of certain species. If you think of it, everybody gets told over here that elephants are endangered, and that creates funding for a lot of these organizations. Another species which is not under threat at all in Africa, it has got very few people wanting to hunt them. They've got more than enough habitat, is giraffe. And yet your animal rights are now pushing giraffe to be listed as endangered. Why? Because it's a sellable species for them. It is a cute long eyelash species that's easy to sell.
Long eyelash species, yes. A charismatic megafauna.
Exactly.
Whoever coined that phrase, that's a good one. I heard that one. Like, that's exactly what it is. But it's
but
these
that just
big
shows you where
animals.
Where the intent is.
Yeah,
it's not
so
about
we
the
have something kind of similar going on here in the New World with polar bears. You know, they're listing them as endangered. Their numbers have never been higher. You can't import the hides back into America.
Yes, yeah.
You can do it anywhere. It's not illegal to hunt them.
No.
You just can't bring them back. And so they're, you know, in Canada, they're seeing the same thing. Like, people aren't going to hunt them. They're not spending the money on them.
But all that does is it takes away a lot of opportunity for conservation funding for those species.
Absolutely.
By not importing those trophies.
Absolutely.
And that
doesn't
cost the government a cent.
No.
It's out of private money. It's private funding of these projects.
Yeah.
And yet it's been stopped for no apparent reason.
And we have a battle going on right here in Minnesota with the Canadian lynx. So we're on the very southern edge of their territory, of their natural territory. Northern Minnesota has lynx. And we have a zone, the northeastern part of the state, is you can't trap lynx. Well, you can't even trap. There's certain ways you have it. You can only trap certain ways for certain animals to eliminate incidental catches.
Sure.
You know, and I've touched on this on my show before, where it's like in the last 10 years, there's only been a handful of incidental catches, like over 10 years, mm-hmm. and then of those 10 years, only 6 were fatal. So it's like that's not even, those aren't even real numbers.
No.
Like that, you're not impacting the lynx population at all. A, you can't, because if you look, and it's the same thing. Like, I thought the lynx was endangered because that's kind of what you're being spoon-fed. When I looked into it, they're not endangered at all. Their population, they are of least concern.
Yeah.
They are listed as least mm-hmm. concern. So, but the antis are just using that, and the general public doesn't know that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's nobody really countering. Like, that, the news organizations, you know, they'll just let the story run, and then let people think what they want to think. There's no counter. Nobody's countering it.
Exactly.
Nobody's countering the misinformation.
Yeah. And that's one of our biggest threats to what we do is that there's so much misinformation out there, and the media is not supporting it us at all in terms of putting the correct information out. I mean, after that Cecil the Lion incident, did you hear one media report saying, listen, yeah, this was all false? That guy did nothing illegal.
No. Nope.
There's been an investigation. There was nothing wrong with what happened. Nobody said that.
No.
After the sensation was gone, it was just hidden away.
Yeah, and unfortunately, so many people just love to get on social media or whatever it is, and they exercise their outrage, mm-hmm. you know, and they feel like, I don't know, they must feel like they've done something for the world, and then they go right back to playing Candy Crush.
Yeah.
Like, you're not really doing anything. Like, you went on there, you threatened some guy's life, you know, I hope his whole family gets eaten by a lion. You know, people say just absolute terrible stuff. It's just unbelievable what people are capable of saying. In, like, ironically, under the guise of trying to be to
and
help.
Yet, and yet those people contribute in no way to actual conservation.
Zero. And if they do donate, they probably do donate to
the wrong people.
The World Wildlife Federation or to HSUS. Yeah. Like, and it's not going anywhere, you know.
No.
Are there organizations that people can, outside of, you know, going on a hunt yourself, mm-hmm. like if somebody wanted to be more proactive, not able to go over, maybe not interested in hunting. Yeah. Are there organizations you're aware of that?
There are, but the best, what I tell people is try to get in contact, like, through myself or through actual people on the ground, our national parks or our private reserves in South Africa, and go to them and say, listen here, where are your requirements? What do you need? Can we send you equipment? Can we send you night vision equipment? Can we send you tracking devices? Can we send you whatever? Instead of dumping a bunch of money into some organization that it just disappears, rather go to people on the ground and say to them, listen, what do you guys need? Where are your requirements? Instead of sending a bunch of money, put a funding campaign together and buy some of the good high technology equipment that we cannot afford over there and ship that over to them. That is one of the best bits of advice I can give for something like
that. There's plenty of elephants.
Plenty of elephants.
There's plenty of giraffes.
Loads
what are
of
some
giraffes.
Of the other big marquee species that kind of fall under that PR problem?
Most of the species over there are way out of threat. There are certain species that are still under threat, things like your African hunting dog, African wild dog. They're under threat, and it basically comes down to habitat loss. Those species need vast, vast tracts of land to sustain the amount of prey they need and et cetera, et cetera. And they also a huge threat to livestock farming and that. When they get in there, they can decimate herds in no time.
I bet they like goat.
So that's a major threat, and the only way we can really provide for them is by creating wild areas. And the best way of creating wild areas is making them sustainable and able to pay for themselves in the long run. So through providing funding through hunting, through providing funding through ecotourism, that is the best way of conserving species like that. If you want to conserve Africa, come visit. Come spend your money. Go visit these wildlife areas. Every day you spend in those wildlife areas, you're helping pay for the future of those areas.
You have to give the animals value, more value than a crop.
Exactly.
Or more value. That animal has to have more value than a head of cattle.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just going
to
have.
To ensure its right to exist.
I mean, you just.
It's economics.
Boil it down to economics. Exactly. It's like whatever's going to make them the most money, they're going to do that.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so that. If you take anything away from this conversation, it's mm-hmm. that. Like, try to convey that to people mm-hmm. that are uneducated, that are on the fence, that don't have a horse in the race. They're not hunters, yet they're not anti-hunting or animal rights activists, but they're somewhere in the middle, which is probably the vast majority of people living in cities.
Yeah, the best way to have anything have a future is to be able to give it the opportunity to pay for itself, to fund its own existence. As soon as you've got to use money from somewhere else to fund something, it eventually runs out. If you create opportunity for a species to fund itself, you'll ensure its existence forever. Create an opportunity for a community to exist alongside, to generate income for themselves, they'll provide habitat for that as long as they're there. So that's the answer to a lot of it, especially in your African system.
Yeah, and so going back to the rhino real quick, this is just my curiosity. Are there rhino hunts that people can be a part of, or is that
There are rhino hunts that can be a part of. They're pretty spendy and that kind of thing, but it's an important part. What we need for rhinos to survive is to legalize the trade in rhino horn.
Okay, so that's the big one.
The big one. And all of these animal rights are fighting against it because they know if we legalize rhino horn trade, poaching will end. You end poaching, what do they sell? You'll cut off a major part of their income source. At the end of the day, at the moment, a rhino is worth more dead than alive. A poacher comes in, he kills it, he hacks off the horn, and he sells it. If we can harvest rhino horn, you can tranquilize that animal. You can cut off 2/3 of its horn every 2 years. It just grows back like a fingernail. You can harvest that horn without influencing that animal at all, without harming that animal at all. You can put that on the market, bring the price down.
And the rhino never dies.
And all of that money, first of all, goes through a controlled system. Taxes can be paid on that. That money can be used for conservation. The landowners generating and protecting these rhinos can suddenly get enough money to up their protection and up the conservation, which will create more habitat for live rhinos.
Could there be something, and maybe this is going on, I don't know, I just had the thought pop into my head, like, you think anybody would be willing to pay for the hunt, if you will, in air quotes, to tranquilize, to trank the rhino?
And then that's exactly it. You could then bring somebody in to be part of that whole thing.
Do the whole grip and grin with the animal in front of them, just like it's dead.
Unfortunately, the law doesn't permit the use of the tranquilizers. So that has to be done by a qualified veterinarian. But you can have somebody go along in those exercises, pay for that experience. I mean, just going along and being able to touch a live rhino.
Can you imagine? Imagine.
I
would lose my mind. Like, that would be, that'd be like this, for me, it'd be like the scene in Jurassic Park where he sees the Triceratops for the first time. If I got to put my hand on a black rhino, I would freak out.
Yeah, it is something amazing. I mean, just to see those creatures in their natural environment, and it's probably the most prehistoric animal you'll ever look at.
I mean, I think that's like the biggest win-win. I mean, right there, to trank a rhino, get the thrill of the hunt, get all that, get the picture, and then know that animal is still alive and it's going to be able to breed on.
Yeah. You harvest a portion of the horn, that gets sold off, and that, I mean, rhino horn at the moment on the black market is worth more than gold per ounce.
It's unbelievable.
It's crazy. And the ban on trade at the moment bans legal trade. It has had absolutely no influence on illegal trade. It's actually stimulated illegal
trade.
Well,
absolutely. Yeah. It's anytime. I mean, look at the history of man, you know, here in the States with Prohibition. Did people stop consuming alcohol?
No.
You just gave all the money and all the power to
the wrong ones.
To the underground, to the criminal underground. Like, that's what happens when you ban stuff.
Yeah.
We just don't.
With a ban on the round horn trade. Absolutely. It's going to be the same on the ban of trophy imports. There's nothing good that comes from it.
And, you know, and it goes back, like we said, give it the financial give them a reason to keep rhinos alive.
Exactly. You need that incentive.
If rhinos bring in money,
everybody will want them.
People will make sure there are rhinos.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But if they don't, whatever. And the ones that are poaching it, just shooting them, cutting the horn off and leaving them lay, they don't care. If they exhaust that resource, they'll move on to the next one.
Exactly.
And in fact, the closer they get to extinction, the more their value goes up.
Yeah, the more they're going to go after it. Yeah.
So you're driving that market instead of a lawful, regulated, monitored business.
Exactly. You need to create an incentive for people to want to have those animals on their property. And at the moment, having rhino on your property is a liability. It's costing you a fortune. It's a risk to your livelihood. People will come in and kill you to kill your rhino.
That's just insane.
Whereas if you could create a value to that animal where you could create an income, provide the security required for these animals, provide the habitat required, and it's a simple no-brainer. It's right in front of us. We just need the world to stand up and realize it. And we need the people to stand up and tell the governments, listen here, we need to stop this. This is not working.
Is that on the African government? I mean, you say African government like it's one thing, but
worldwide. Unfortunately, South Africa is part of CITES, which is your Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Now, that when it was started, had a lot of good ideas about controlling and regulating international trade, which is great. It has now become an organization that wants to ban countries from utilizing their wildlife. That's not what it's about. We now have countries telling us what we should be doing with our rhinos, yet they have no interest in rhinos. They have no rhinos of their own. They have no, they do not contribute towards rhino conservation. Yet they want to have a vote and tell us how we should be conserving and utilizing our rhinos. Just doesn't make sense.
Well, if you talk about the industry, just how, like, if it was legal, you'd be promoting more rhinos and that would be bringing in the money. Right now, where is the money? The money is these anti-hunting campaigns.
Exactly.
They're making money off of pulling your heartstrings.
Yes.
They don't want it. Yeah. They don't want it legalized because now their market, which is people's well-meaning emotions and hearts towards these iconic animals, that's where they make their money.
Exactly.
And it's abhorrent.
And unfortunately, none of it is going to the right place. And if you had to bring down the poaching, that would just take away their sales, because that's what they're selling. And unfortunately, it's heartbreaking, because us guys on the ground are fighting a massive war against all of this, and at the moment we aren't winning. At the moment we are losing this battle, and that's why we just need more people on the ground to get in and support and tell their politicians, listen here, we need to stop this. We need to change this.
Yeah, it would be nice to get some bigger name backers, but that's tough too. You know, like these Hollywood elites,
there's a lot of guys standing up and doing it. There's a lot of well-known guys in the U.S. standing up. There's organizations standing up and doing it. Dallas Safari Club, Safari Club International.
SCI, I think.
All of these guys are putting big money into fighting it, into talking to politicians and getting people involved in that. There's a lot happening, but we need more people on the ground getting involved and contributing. And it doesn't need to be financial. It needs to be writing a letter to your congressman, writing a letter to your government officials, to your game organizations, and saying, listen here, how can we get involved? How can we support conservation in Africa? It's vitally important.
And I think it's changing the dialogue. At least that's my take on it and what I've been harping on this show, like how we interact with other people, you know, instead of, you know, we started the podcast off, like, instead of bashing somebody else or throwing the insults back,
you know, I try to get people away from, you know, using terms that we use here, like libtard, you know, someone's a liberal. Like, you know, this derogatory terms doesn't ever win anybody over.
You're not getting anywhere.
They're just going to dig their heels in. They're going to call you a redneck or whatever, you know, whatever the derogatory term is. Be cool-headed. Have facts on your side. And I think stuff that we've talked about in this podcast I think are great. I think these are what people need to know. So now on a personal level, I want, before we wrap this up, I want to talk about the table fare. I'm going to get back to that because that's what I'm interested in. So so if you go on one of these hunts, you get to sample. Is it like when they go out and harvest an animal, or you already have some just like at the freezer back at the lodge?
Yeah, we've got a bunch of prepared meat, sausage and burger and whatever else from species we've hunted previously. Because when you're there, you're only hunting a few species, but you'd like to taste a lot more.
Everything.
So
we've got
some pre-prepared.
You're going to have to bring me a meat and cheese plate. There's like some of everything. Yeah. How many plains game animals were there that you can hunt?
Plains game, there's over 30 plains game animals, but over 50
have a big
huntable species.
That's a big meat plate. I want to try all of them.
And they're all good. And that's what we try to do. Is like when you're hunting, we try to take a little bit of almost everything you hunt and eat that, as well as some of the other species that you might not have opportunity to hunt while you're there.
What's your favorite animal to hunt?
Elephant.
You like elephant?
Yeah. Elephant, buffalo are probably two of my favorite in terms of pure adrenaline, pure excitement. I mean, you can imagine holding a little rifle in your hand and walking up to a 13,000-pound, 12-foot-tall elephant at 10, 15, 20 yards.
Oh, my God.
I mean, if that's not going to get you going, nothing is. Getting into a herd of Cape buffalo of 20, 30, or a few hundred animals, when you're in 30, 40 yards from them, you can smell them right around you. That's exciting. That gets you going. It's all there. It's all there. I mean, when it comes to hunting and living and being part of what's around you, it doesn't get better than that.
That sounds frightening and yet amazing at the same time. That would be quite the rush. Yeah. So what's your favorite animal to eat?
I've been asked that so many times, and to be honest, I couldn't pick one. There's a bunch of different ones that I've eaten that have been right up there. Eland is great. Hippopotamus is awesome. Zebra is great. Sable, some of the best meat I've eaten is off of sable. But little things like impala, that chicken fried steak off of an impala, any of that, you just can't beat it.
The hippo, I think, is I've never heard that until I talked to you today.
Okay.
And I don't know why. I mean, we like to eat pigs. I mean, not that they're a pig, but they kind of resemble them in a way. Mm-hmm. And then, like we said, like elephant is tough and grainy just because they're so massive. They're moving their own. You know, those muscles are getting workout all the time.
Yes.
But the hippo, while being very large,
it doesn't do a whole bunch.
They're supported by water most of the time, so they're using their muscles, but not in the same fashion on dry land like elephants are. And you're saying it's marbled, like has good marbling in it.
Good marbling.
How is like hippopotamus fat?
It has a lot of fat on the outside that we generally cut off, but once you get into the steaks and that kind of stuff, it's very lightly marbled with fat, a very tender, very pleasant flavor. I can't fault any of it.
Does the fat, is it more tallow-like fat?
It's a very white fat.
Okay.
Very, very white.
Is it the waxy fat?
Pretty waxy.
Tallow, yeah. So.
Well, different parts of it obviously changes in that.
Sure.
It's very similar to pork
here,
fat.
Like
very similar
fat.
To pork
oh,
fat.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah. So you could render it down into like lard or something
you
like
could,
that?
You could, yes, yeah.
Would
and there's enough of
would
it.
Would it be pretty similar?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because like here, like nobody really uses deer fat.
Yeah.
It's very waxy. Like you eat it, it leaves a film on your teeth. Like it's just not really that pleasant. So most people trim the fat off of their venison.
Yeah.
But maybe you don't want to trim too much off your hippopotamus chops.
Yeah. No, we do trim a lot of just because there's too much of it. If you had to leave it all on, there's
how much meat would you get off of a full grown hippo?
For the size of the animal, it's actually not as much because a lot of it is skin. I mean, the skin on a hippo is over an inch thick. A lot of it is guts. A lot of it is big, heavy bones.
Okay.
So from a two-ton hippo, you're probably only going to get probably 800 pounds of actual meat.
Oh, wow.
So same with elephants, although it's a huge,
like a
big animal.
Almost.
Yeah, yeah. Your actual meat off of those big animals is a very small percentage compared to most of the antelope species.
Are there crocodile hunts?
There are crocodile hunts in a lot of your river systems and lake systems over there.
How's the table fare in a croc?
We
eat alligator here, so.
Yeah. Once again, with crocodile, your farmed crocodile, where it's in a controlled environment, controlled food source, the meat is really good. Your wild hunted crocodiles that I've eaten have not been quite as good.
Probably eating rotten hippos and everything else, probably not so
where
great.
They are and what they eat and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It definitely has a lot stronger flavor than your farmed crocodiles.
How about like some of your primates, like your baboons and stuff? Are there hunts for those as well?
We do hunt baboons and monkeys over there. I've eaten baboon before. It's not bad. It's
is that
not
what they call, is that bush meat? Is that what they refer to as bush meat?
Yeah, bush meat. All of that. All your antelope and baboons they'd call bush meat over there and that. But yeah, it's not something I'm going to go out and pursue and
that
hunt
would be
as
weird.
As table fare.
I'd be the first one to admit that like.
But
like
because I have hunted them, I have eaten them.
Dressing a monkey would be weird
because
it looks too much like me.
Yeah.
It would be odd, but I'd probably try. I don't want to try anything once.
Yeah.
But people do. So are there protected species? Like are there things that just aren't, like you can't?
Well, pretty much all your antelope and elephant and buffalo and all of that are protected over there. They are protected. So everything has to go through a permitting system.
Okay.
So nothing is just open game there.
Yeah, well,
so
yeah,
everything
I guess
is regulated
I guess I
and controlled.
Worded that the wrong way.
Species in South Africa that are not huntable are species like cheetah, African wild dog, and a few of the others. And then there's species that are huntable but that are not exportable to certain countries. Like in South Africa, we hunt species like brown hyena, but you're not allowed to import that into the USA.
Got right,
you can
sure.
take it into Canada. You can take it into most of your European countries,
not
the USA.
Yeah, we got to figure out a way to get that reversed. I don't know how that's going to happen.
And what is countering the conservation of those species?
A net loss.
As soon as you allow your citizens to import those trophies, you're contributing directly to the conservation of that individual species. You must know conservation of these species is important to no one more than us. Our entire livelihoods, our existence, our lifestyle is totally dependent on the conservation of these species. So there's nobody that it's more important to than your hunters to ensure the survival of them. So who better to put the responsibility of the protection with as to your hunters and allow your people to fund that?
Yeah, I mean, if you're, I guess we can, if your concern is increasing the numbers of wildlife in Africa, then do it the right way.
Yeah, exactly.
Get the facts on your side.
And it's
just
proven
feeling,
that
feeling
it works.
Good about it, feeling good that you can't export rhino horn while the rhino is in danger.
Just kind of productive.
You got to be honest with yourself, and you're not. It's not helping.
Yeah.
You got to help. At least you don't have to do it, but at least be an ally of it.
Definitely.
Yeah. So. Give everybody your information. How can they get a hold of you?
You can get a hold of me through my websites, hannesswanepoelsafaris.co.za, or on Facebook, Hannes Swanepoel Safaris on Facebook, and various other ways. While I'm in the States, my contact number is 208-875-9322. You can contact me through that, or the best way is probably through websites and Facebook.
Well, I'll try to get this edited and put up tonight, released, so I can send you a link on your email and you can
That'll be awesome, yeah.
blast it out on your social media as much as you want or wherever you want. And again, Hans, appreciate you taking the time. This was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I'd go for another hour if I could, but.
Yeah thank you for the opportunity to spread the word. We need to. It's our responsibility to spread the word and get the correct information. And thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. Thank you.